Medicine can do a power of good, but in the wrong hands, it can become a force for evil.
It was incomprehensible.
A rogue nurse turns the children's ward into a killing field.
She had another go at this tiny baby.
In the hands of a desperate housewife, medicine becomes a deadly weapon.
Some people are so evil, they don't care who they take out.
And a mother with a horrifying compulsion kills her babies and uses a medical diagnosis to hide it.
Two babies were suspicious, but four, that's murder.
These are deadly women, turning the hope of life into death by using bad medicine. Sometimes bad medicine can flourish where it is least expected.
When I graduated from medical school, I took the Hippocratic Oath. I swore to do no harm.
It can hide in plain view.
You don't expect a killer to be in the environment where nurturing is the nature of the business.
As it did in England, in the Grantham Hospital Children's Ward in 1991.
It was incomprehensible. Incomprehensible.
23-year-old nurse Beverly Allitt is a star on Ward 4. Parents want her to monitor their sick children because she seems to have a sixth sense for danger. She's always there when trouble strikes.
Arrest! Code red! Code red! Arrest!
I was a staff nurse working on the wards. Beverly came to work with us as an enrolled nurse to help us care for the children.
In 1991, Mary Reet found herself on the front line of bad medicine. There was a spike in emergency incidents in her ward, as children on the mend were suddenly dying.
At first, we thought maybe there was some kind of infection that we couldn't identify that was causing problems.
Mary would later discover she was working with a serial killer. But at the time, she was concentrating only on saving lives.
One particular evening, I was on duty, and Beverly had gone to feed the baby, Patrick Elston. He was a tiny wee fella. He was about 9 weeks old.
Hi. There's something wrong with Patrick.
She called me to say that he had stopped breathing.
Oh, he's arresting.
We resuscitated him successfully. And he was making nice progress, doing really well, and was no cause for concern.
Mary Reet had no idea Nurse Allitt had made an unsuccessful attempt to suffocate baby Patrick. Later that evening, she strikes again.
Arrest! Code red! Arrest!
This time, baby Patrick stops breathing.
So again, we resuscitated him. This time, he was evacuated to the intensive care unit because obviously, although we'd resuscitated him, he was quite sick.
Eventually, Mary learns the true horror of that night.
I realized that we had saved him the first time, but then we put him in danger's way again. I still struggle with that. She had another go at this tiny baby. I'm sorry.
Baby Patrick suffers permanent brain damage. There's no shortage of new victims for Nurse Allett as unsuspecting parents hand over their children. By April 1991, the hospital knows something's wrong in Ward 4. They count 25 suspicious incidents. Investigator Neil Jones is called in to look for unnatural causes. One incident he investigated still haunts him today.
Becky Phillips was on the ward with diarrhea. Nothing more serious for that. And she was due to go home. And before she went home, she was fed by Beverly Allett.
But food isn't the only thing Nurse Allett administers to Becky. She injects her with insulin.
When you have an insulin overdose, there's no sugar or fuel available for any of the cells in the body to use. And as a result, the body starts to shut down. First the brain, and then the heart, and then the rest of the body.
Her parents, thinking Becky is well again, take her home.
And when she got home, she became sweaty, clammy, irritable. They couldn't do anything with her. They rang for the ambulance. It was slow in coming.
At 3 a.m., five-month-old Becky dies in her parents' arms. Later, an autopsy will reveal the shocking truth.
She had something like 9,300 millimoles of insulin within her body. And unfortunately, Becky had gone home, so they couldn't treat her, they couldn't give her sugar, and she died.
It was unheard of for a nurse to do this. It wasn't thought of. Nobody thought that it was a possibility, and so we didn't look for it to be one of us.
Becky has a twin sister, Katie. To avoid losing another child, the parents book Katie into Ward 4 as a precaution. They have no idea Beverly has killed one daughter and now has the other in her hands. Katie Phillips' twin sister died just days earlier. And now, in Children's Ward 4, at England's Grantham Hospital, the five-month-old baby is fighting for her life.
Over the next 4 days, Katie had four relapses, and she was found unconscious, usually in the arms of Beverly Allett.
Nurse Beverly Allett is the children's savior in Ward 4.
Parents were asking for her to actually sit with their children because she was the one that was raising the alarm.
But little do they know, parents are consigning their children to death or serious injury.
I baptize you, Katie, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Katie Phillips is now permanently brain damaged due to lack of oxygen. But incredibly, her attacker is asked to be her godmother. A tribute to the heroic nurse who saved her life.
When someone's child is in a life-threatening situation, they're very vulnerable, and a nurse or caretaker can seize that opportunity to ingratiate themselves and feel good about the role they're playing.
And this, investigators would uncover, is what drives Beverly Allett. A need to be loved and respected. A diagnosed medical condition.
Munchausen by proxy is a condition wherein the individual hurts someone else to gain attention for themselves. People go into this profession that suffer from Munchausen or Munchausen by proxy because it gives them access to victims.
And in England's Grantham Hospital Children's Ward, Beverly has easy access to helpless victims.
She was almost frenetic about her attacks. There was no cooling off period. She would attack on the average of every other day that we know of. Probably more attacks than that. So this was a frenzy of attacking and killing, which is unusual for a female serial killer.
But once police are called in, Nurse Allett's two-month reign in Ward 4 begins to disintegrate. Even though she is held above suspicion by the staff and grateful parents, cold, hard forensics expose her bad medicine. Autopsies show lethal traces of insulin in victims. Some have potassium, too, from unauthorized anesthetic shots. Other tiny bodies have fractured ribs and internal bruising from being squeezed or suffocated.
Beverly was clever enough to put some thought and planning into how she was going to kill. She might use a particular drug on one child and a totally different method or drug on another.
And there was one common link through every death or injury: Beverly's appearance as the apparent savior.
I think now there was 21 or 23 nurses who were involved on the ward. And of all the cases, only Beverly Allett was present.
Beverly Allett is charged with the murder of four children, the attempted murder of another three, and inflicting grievous bodily harm on a further six children. Found guilty on May 28, 1993, she is sentenced to 13 concurrent terms of life imprisonment.
What bothers me most when medical professionals use their privilege and misuse the trust that's placed in them to cause damage to others. It casts a pall over all of us.
I suspect it's made parents more wary of us and more nervous about trusting us to look after their children.
It says a lot about the inability of our medical system to really know their practitioners well enough. That's probably the scariest part of the story.
Some doses of bad medicine are so unexpected, so astonishing, they are almost impossible to detect. At least that's what one murderer was hoping in the summer of 1986 in Auburn, Washington. Forty-year-old bank manager Sue Snow wakes herself with a morning ritual. Two Excedrin painkillers.
That morning, like every other morning, she took a couple of capsules. She took them instead of drinking a cup of coffee. She wanted the buzz from the caffeine, which is part of the pill. The next thing that happened, her daughter, Haley, heard a thump. She went into the bathroom and found her mother on the floor,
Mom?
Unconscious.
What's wrong? Are you okay?
It looked like she might be dead.
Mom? Dad? Mom?
It appears that the headache capsules are to blame. Writer Greg Olson has chronicled the crimes of many deadly women. This possible poisoning is very close to home.
was a panic here. Everybody in the Seattle area was dumping their bottles in, you know, in the toilet or throwing them in the garbage.
Whatever was in the capsules was very potent. Sue Snow had died in the hospital a few hours after taking them. An autopsy report would soon show why.
One of the medical examiners, an assistant, during the autopsy, she smelled bitter almonds. She smelled the scent.
Only about 50% of the population can detect this. It's something that is inherited or not. But once detected, it is very unmistakable. And at that point, you would suspect cyanide poisoning.
Someone had tampered with the capsules, adding lethal concentrations of cyanide.
We were scared. We were thinking, you know, we could have this stuff in our house too.
6 days earlier, there was another suspicious death.
What do you want?
Bruce Nickel has a headache, so his wife Stella offers Excedrin.
Cyanide is a rapidly acting, very potent poison. Basically, what happens is you can no longer use the oxygen that's bound to the hemoglobin molecule in your red blood cells. Your lungs would start to compensate by breathing more quickly, your heart rate would be abnormal, and pretty soon you're going to have very profound damage to the lungs, the brain, and the heart. And death would follow.
Bruce Nickel dies in the hospital just hours after taking the Excedrin capsules. After Sue Snow's death, authorities warned the public about Excedrin, recalling it from the shelves. They fear even more deaths.
If we had held off even a day, then it's likely that someone else or multiple other people would have died from that.
Detective Mike Dunbar was assigned the case that would bring him face to face with the coldest of killers.
Back in those days, we didn't have a lot of protective devices on capsules and packaged medicines to keep them from being tampered with.
Within days of the recall, police get the call they dread. Another possible victim, Stella's husband, Bruce.
He had just seen the news report and that he had taken Excedrin capsules of the same lot number that we had publicized and wanted the county sheriff to come out to her house and check.
The police came out to see Stella at her trailer and she said, here's a bottle that he took. He took some capsules from this bottle just before he died.
Stella hands over two bottles of the suspect painkillers. She said she'd bought at two different stores. So far, forensic testing of thousands of recalled bottles has found only two positives for cyanide. But then something extraordinary. Stella Nickel's bottles test positive. Both of them.
How could somebody be so unlucky to go from one store in one town to another store in another town and end up with two of the five bottles that were eventually discovered? I mean, come on. It's not going to happen.
Statistically, it was nearly impossible that she randomly went to those stores and randomly purchased those two bottles. And that was initially what pointed to her as a very good suspect.
Stella Nickel races straight to the top of the suspect list. But two things are missing: motivation and proof. Auburn, Washington, 1986. Headache tablets have killed two victims in 1 week. Sue Snow and Bruce Nickel. Both are poisoned by tampered Excedrin capsules, laced with cyanide. a killer has randomly planted deadly pills in several stores. After a national product recall of tens of thousands of bottles, police discover five are tainted with cyanide.
As I recall, there was, you know, somewhere between 7 and 9 contaminated capsules in each of the bottles. So, I mean, you could wipe out a family quite easily.
But incredibly, 2 of those 5 bottles were bought by the same person. The wife of one of the victims, Stella Nickel.
The idea that she bought those 2 bottles at 2 different places was astronomical. It just didn't seem like that could make sense.
Statistically, the odds are almost impossible. Police suspect Stella Nickel is somehow linked to the murders. They start digging into her past.
Stella grew up rough. She'd been raped. She'd had a baby at 14. She had a mother that had 7 husbands. She had a brother who was murdered in their house. I mean, she had everything bad that you can have happen to a person.
But a bad life alone doesn't make a murderer. And Stella has no connection to one of the victims, Sue Snow.
The female predator who chooses strangers to kill is unusual. Generally speaking, when females kill in a serial fashion, they choose people that they know.
The indiscriminate poisoning of random shoppers suggests the murderer is a sociopath, the kind often encountered by criminal profiler Candace DeLong.
People that are sociopaths do wear what's known as a mask of sanity, frequently being married, having children, holding jobs, and no one knows about their murderous deeds.
Was Stella Nickel wearing a mask of sanity? Police investigations are getting closer to the truth.
Once they started digging into her background, they found all these life insurance policies.
It was learned that she had taken out insurance policies in her husband's name without his knowledge and had forged his signature on them.
They found a marriage that was fractured beyond belief.
She seemed to like the party life. She liked to go out on the town and go to the local lounges and bars, and she liked men.
And they found a woman who was basically so greedy, it seemed like she'd do anything for money.
The forged life insurance policy is worth more to Stella if her husband dies accidentally.
Basically, she'd get another $100,000 if it was an accidental death. Murder is an accidental death.
Police start to believe Stella murdered her husband for profit. But she needed the right accident to collect, one that covered her tracks. So she creates an accident that also kills others. Poisoned medicine.
She just needed one. She needed one person to die so she could make that phone call.
Her crime was well planned out, premeditated down to the last detail.
Police believe Stella used Sue Snow's death to make sure she got her insurance payout.
In her case, it appeared to be purely random. She just was an innocent victim who happened to buy a bottle of contaminated Excedrin capsules.
The crime is so monstrous, investigators need hard evidence to convince a jury. But Stella left some clues.
So the FBI went down to the library. They produced several books that Stella Nickel had checked out. And when they analyzed the pages on cyanide in 2 different encyclopedias, they found Stella Nickel's fingerprints all over them.
And there is more evidence. Whoever contaminated the capsules left strange green specks amongst the cyanide and painkiller.
They did further analysis of those specks and determined that they were a product called algae destroyer, which is what an aquarium enthusiast uses to kill algae in their fish tank.
Investigators remember seeing an aquarium at Stella's house. It's a long shot, but police check fish stores in the area.
And they came up with one in Renton, Washington, that Stella had frequented. And the fellow there said, I sold that product to Stella. I'm absolutely sure of it. I told her to crush it up in a bowl to soften it.
Those traces of the algicide got into the cyanide by grinding the tablets up in the same container as the algicide. And that's how the five bottles were tied together.
Thanks to great detective work, Stella's fish tank gives her away. Police are now sure they have their murderer.
Stella was a classic copycat killer in that she was duplicating the method of killing that was used in one of the most notorious and highly publicized mass murders in the United States, that being the Tylenol murders in Chicago of 1982.
Stella's scheme is coming undone. 5 months later, the insurance company isn't paying out. There's too much doubt about her husband's death.
Do you intend to lie to me on this test today?
No.
Stella agrees to a polygraph to clear her name.
She thought, the only way for me to get those bucks is for me to take that polygraph and I can beat it.
Stella fails the test, and things just get worse. Police pressure her 27-year-old daughter, Cindy.
The FBI told her, if you cooperate with us, you'll get a chunk of that reward. It's a $250,000 reward.
Cindy spills the beans.
I just remember this conversation.
She said, yeah, my mom and I talked about different ways of killing my dad.
Despite pleading innocence, Stella Nickel is convicted and jailed for 90 years. The charges, an American first. 2 counts of murder by product tampering.
For someone to go out and poison medicine in store shelves, for innocent people to come along and purchase and die to put additional money in her pocket, shows that she has no conscience in my mind.
That's what's so compelling about this story, the idea that some people are so evil, so uncaring, so determined to get what they want, they don't care who they take out.
In medicine, there are still many mysteries. Some diseases remain hard to explain, and even harder to cure. But to misrepresent medical symptoms to cover up the murder of innocents is the very worst kind of medicine. Kathleen Fallbig and her husband Craig are about to endure a run of misfortune beyond tragedy. It starts one night in 1989 in their Newcastle home near Sydney, Australia.
I would imagine that it would be every father's worst nightmare.
She was actually one of the worst people that could ever raise children.
The Fallbigs' son is just 3 weeks old. He is their first child, the start of their family. But now Kathleen makes a terrible discovery. Their son is dead. Later, the diagnosis is sudden infant death syndrome, the mysterious affliction also known as SIDS.
What we see is that these children really die as a result of asphyxia. They are simply not breathing. This happens when they're asleep.
Forensic pathologist Dr. Janice Amatuzio knows the uncertainty surrounding SIDS. It's diagnosed only when all other causes have been ruled out.
There's been numerous thoughts and nothing known for sure, but it's thought that it's a possibility that these children may simply stop breathing. Perhaps their breathing center may not be as well developed in their brain.
To the world, the Fallbigs are just another unfortunate couple who've lost a baby to sudden infant death syndrome. What no one knows, including grieving dad Craig, is that this won't be the last of the tragedy.
Some women lose a child accidentally that truly dies in their crib by SIDS, and the mother of the child is afraid to ever go through that grief again, so she never has another child. Not women that kill their own children. They want to do it again and again, and what we see is them having a child every year.
Just over a year later, Kathleen gives birth to another son. And soon, tragedy strikes again. Just 4 months old, Kathleen's second baby seems to be asphyxiated. Again, it is Kathleen who discovers the problem. Craig desperately tries to resuscitate his son.
Call an ambulance! Now.
This time, Craig's quick actions save his baby boy. Although the near asphyxiation will leave him blind and epileptic. But within a year, he would be dead.
It's happened again!
Again from asphyxia. This time thought to be brought on by an epileptic fit. The Fallbigs have lost two young sons in 2 years to breathing disorders. No one suspects anything but devastating misfortune. But Kathleen knows the truth. She's been secretly confiding in her diaries.
One of the most telling diaries of all came when she wrote, "My brain has too much happening, unstored and unrecalled memories just waiting. Heaven help the day they surface and I recall. That will be the day to lock me up and throw away the key."
Journalist and author Matthew Benz has documented the life and crimes of Kathleen Fallbig. He shows how Kathleen used bad medicine to conceal the murder of her own children.
This series of crimes is particularly horrible because it involves the sacred bond between a mother and child. It's very hard to believe that that trust could be broken in such a way.
Kathleen was killing her children and then using medical conditions to conceal her murders. And the Fallbig family is in for more misfortune. Much more. In Newcastle, Australia, a young couple seems to be having a tragic run of bad medicine. Both their baby sons have died of asphyxiation. One diagnosed as sudden infant death syndrome, the other from epileptic seizure.
Hey, you're right.
But the truth is even more tragic. Their mother, Kathleen Fallbig, is secretly killing them. But no one suspects her. Instead, they feel sorry for her. A mother whose children have been besieged by medical tragedies. But Kathleen has a secret past that may well ensure she will kill again.
She really had a script written for her that was directing trouble for the rest of her life.
Kathleen's father, Thomas Britton, was not a very nice man by all accounts. He had served 8 months for grievous bodily harm for slashing his first wife's throat. He had fathered several children before he met Kathleen Donovan, who was Kathy Fallbig's mother.
Kathleen's father stabbed her mother 24 times. When he was through with the killing, an extraordinary thing happened.
Sorry, Dara. I had to do it.
Kathleen's father apologized to his victim. He told a witness he'd stabbed his wife to stop her killing his daughter, Kathleen, just 18 months old at the time.
She was then placed with an aunt and uncle, and it suggested that at this time she was severely sexually abused.
I think that Kathleen was very affected by her first 3 years of life.
Crown Prosecutor Mark Tedeschi, QC, would come to learn of Kathleen's terrible past.
She had a personality disorder which originated during those very early years of her life. It was what they called an attachment disorder.
Some people grow out of those circumstances and turn to the bottle or drugs or can become mad. Very few of them turn to violence. Kathleen did.
I don't understand what you want.
The Fallbigs now have a third child, an 11-month-old daughter. One night, she is restless with a cold and won't go to sleep. Something in Kathleen snaps.
She had this disorder of connection with her own children, which caused her to lose control and enter these stages of rage against her children. That resulted in their deaths.
Another mysterious death is diagnosed as sudden infant death syndrome. Multiple SIDS cases should have raised doctors' suspicions. But the Fallbigs have moved several times, and no one's connecting the dots. Not even the husband, Craig.
When the SIDS diagnosis was developed in the 70s, it gave people like Kathleen an out.
There are no distinctive pathological findings during a post-mortem where you have a SIDS death. So that makes it very difficult for pathologists and it makes it very difficult for investigators.
Incredibly, there would be one more child and one more murder. Kathleen and Craig have a second daughter.
It happened again.
When she is 19 months old, Kathleen kills her. She reports it as another Sid's asphyxiation. But this time, authorities don't buy it.
Toddlers don't die in their cribs from Sid's death. Sid's is caused by a child suffocating. A toddler, if they are having trouble breathing, can simply turn themselves over very easily.
The expert view was that to lose one baby was a tragedy. To lose two babies was suspicious, but four, that's murder.
For long-suffering husband Craig, the horrifying truth is slowly descending. And if he still has any doubts his wife had killed his children, the discovery of her diaries puts an end to it.
Many of the diary extracts revealed her pent-up anger and her rage and her frustration with herself that once again she'd lost it with the children. His whole world must have been torn asunder. The woman who had borne him four children suddenly seemed as though perhaps she hadn't been taking the best care of them after all.
Her diaries were really very tragic and very sad, because what they showed was that she had also suffered a terrible loss when her children died. I'm utterly convinced that within moments of her children dying, she regretted her actions and desperately wanted to try and revive them.
I'm sorry.
The Fallbigs are no longer a family. All the children are gone, and now the marriage is over. Kathleen is charged with multiple murder. The jury takes just 8 hours to find her guilty on 3 counts of murder, 1 count of manslaughter, and 1 count of bodily harm. Kathleen serves a 30-year sentence without parole. She has never admitted guilt, but her story sent around the world a suspicion of bad medicine.
Many sudden infant death syndrome cases are now being looked at, in many cases, unfairly, where they are genuine deaths and the grieving parents are now having to go through the pain again.
To most, it remains an unimaginable crime that challenges our reasoning.
The episodes of anger and rage that she exhibited toward her own children was probably a result of her horrible, horrible childhood and all the psychological damage that was done to her.
She herself recorded in her diaries, "I am my father's daughter."
For all of these deadly women, medicine became their cloak and their killer. They took our trust in the medical world and perverted it to their own evil ends. Kathleen Fallbig used sudden infant death syndrome to hide her killing spree. Stella Nickel turned pills meant to heal into instruments of death. And Beverly Allitt preyed on helpless babies while betraying parents' faith in nurses. We all rely on modern medicine to protect us and often save our lives. These deadly women exploited that trust with bad medicine.
She actually one time faked appendicitis and had surgery.
Let's just have a quick look at the shell.
And then she would not allow the surgical wound to heal. When no one was around, she would pick at the stitches and open it up.
Try not to touch it.
Forensic psychologist and former FBI profiler Candace DeLong knows these early symptoms well. The prime suspect is Sue Snow's husband, who seemed to foreshadow what killed his wife.
Her husband said to one of the doctors, she took Excedrin just before she passed out. Do you think she might have been poisoned with cyanide? The doctors thought, well, why would anyone say that? This is crazy. But what they didn't really think about was that a few years earlier, we had 7 deaths in Chicago related to a Tylenol poisoning that is to this day unsolved.
In 1982, potassium cyanide-laced painkillers poisoned 7 victims and forced a national product recall. Could someone be trying again in Auburn?
Medical examiner ruled that he died of emphysema. Stella Nickel, his wife, kept calling the examiner's office saying, are you sure? I don't think he died of emphysema. He seemed okay yesterday. He doesn't have emphysema. She kept calling and calling and calling.
One of the characteristics of poisoning someone is that you can taint a product they're going to use and not have to be there when they actually use the product.
Because those tablets, it was a tablet form, are sometimes difficult to dissolve. So crush them up in a bowl, mix some water in there, and then put it in your fish tank and it'll kill your algae. And then she said, remember those Tylenol killings back in Chicago? No one ever got caught. Maybe we could do that. And Cindy said that's what she did.
As if that wasn't bad enough, then she's completely abandoned by the family and sent into foster care. This had to have had a profound effect. There's no way a child could suffer those kinds of things and not be affected.
Again, no police investigations are called.
Had Kathleen Fulbig only killed 3 of her children, she would undoubtedly have been undetected and would never have been prosecuted. It was only the 4th death that resulted in the investigation and her convictions.
Anytime an infant dies over 1 year, it's usually not 6. In fact, forensic pathologists, physicians, and investigators everywhere become quite concerned when a child 1.5 or 2 years of age dies. I can tell you, we do not consider that SIDS.
Suspicions turn to horror when Kathleen's trail of misfortune is finally pieced together.
She was actually one of the worst people that could ever raise children.
Get more deadly women online. www.investigationdiscovery.com. To heal into instruments of death. And Beverly Allitt preyed on helpless babies while betraying parents' faith in nurses. We all rely on modern medicine to protect us and often save our lives. These deadly women exploited that trust with bad medicine.